first case on this panel's oral argument scheduled today is Holden v. State, case number 61362. Counsel ready? Okay, all right, Ms. Connelly, go ahead. Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Karen Connelly and I represent Jim Holden. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Jim Holden received an effective assistance of counsel trial in this matter. As a defense lawyer representing Jim Holden, there was three pieces of really bad evidence against him. The first was his statement, the second was his prior conviction for murder, and the third was his alleged journal, a journal that it was alleged that he had written. Trial counsel had an opportunity to keep out all of these pieces of evidence, and he didn't due to ineffective assistance of counsel. I'm going to first talk about the statement. Had Mr. Holden received effective assistance of counsel, his statement would have been suppressed due to Miranda violations. His right to invoke counsel, his right to remain silent, and his right to counsel was violated in this particular case. By way of background, prior to trial, on May 4th, 2006, there was a motion to suppress admissions of Mr. Holden, which was filed by trial counsel. The crux of the argument was his statements were not voluntary. It was a Miranda issue. A motion was filed and a hearing was filed by the court on May 4th, 2006. Judge Ray ruled that the statements were voluntary. Miranda wasn't discussed. The judge, in fact, asked if it was a Miranda issue, and Mr. Giacomo said no. Trial counsel said nothing. The day trial was to commence was February 8, 2006. At the commencement of trial, Mr. Whipple indicated that he had a Miranda issue. He indicated that he had met with his client that weekend and that he'd been advised that when Mr. Holden was initially contacted by the police, which was Metro, he not only said he didn't want to talk with them, but he also invoked his requested a lawyer. By some additional background, in this particular case, Mr. Holden was initially arrested at 7-Eleven. He was stopped by Metro. Metro had him in custody, and it was a North Las Vegas case. Metro contacted North Las Vegas Police Department, and North Las Vegas police came. He was taken to North Las Vegas Police Department. On May 8th, the judge decided to hold a short evidentiary hearing. There had been no motion filed by trial counsel. There was no points of authority to make an oral motion. At the hearing, Mr. Holden testified. Mr. Holden testified that when he was initially stopped by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, they were rude to him, that he refused to talk to them, and he asked for a lawyer. Subsequently, minutes after he'd indicated he didn't want to talk to Metro, North Las Vegas police arrived. They approached him. He testified that they came up to him, they were nice, and they asked him if he would talk, and Mirandized him, and he agreed to talk because they were not rude. The next piece of evidence the judge considered in the hearing was prior testimony of North Las Vegas Police Department Sergeant Morgan. Now, the court reviewed testimony from a prior murder case. Mr. Holden was accused of being involved in two murders. I refer to the first one as a white cap murder case. So there was a hearing in the white cap murder case regarding prior bad acts. Detailing Sergeant Morgan testified in that particular case. Again, in that case, there's no discussion of whether or not Mr. Holden invoked his right to Miranda. However, Sergeant Morgan indicated that based upon what North Las Vegas Police Department had told him, when he was initially stopped, he was Mirandized not only by Metro, he was Mirandized first by Metro and then by North Las Vegas. The next evidence the judge indicated after reviewing the testimony of that police officer that he didn't need to hear actual live testimony. So he was relying upon a transcript from a prior murder case. The court also considered Mr. Holden's voluntary statement in which he indicated again that Metro was disrespectful, that North Las Vegas arrived, and they spoke with him. So the undisputed facts that were established at that evidentiary hearing was that when my client was initially stopped by Metro, he refused to talk and he asked for a lawyer. Then North Las Vegas arrived, they Mirandized him at the scene, they took him to the police department. At the police department, he was Mirandized and he signed a waiver and he gave a statement. At the hearing, the judge's ruling was that Mr. Holden did not want to speak with Metro because they were rude, and that's not a Miranda issue. He ruled there was no Miranda violation. However, there was indeed a violation of my client's Sixth Amendment right to counsel and his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. This was not raised on appeal by appellate counsel. If appellate counsel had raised it, he would have prevailed. In regards to that, to the, as I indicated previously, there was two Miranda errors. The first Miranda error was my client's right to remain silent, and was otherwise known as a Mosley error. In Mosley, the Supreme Court indicated that if a suspect says he doesn't want to talk, then questioning has to stop, and his refusal to speak, his invocation of his right to remain silent, has to be scrupulously honored. And there's four factors that the court has to consider in looking at the totality of the circumstances to determine whether or not his invocation of his right to remain silent was scrupulously honored. The first is whether questioning was immediately ceased. Metro did stop questioning. However, within minutes, North Las Vegas arrived, they approached him, they Mirandized him, and he agreed to talk. So his invocation of his right to remain silent was not scrupulously honored. Also, questioning resumed again almost immediately. There was new Miranda warnings given, and that's one of the factors is whether questioning was immediately ceased, whether they resumed questioning after passage of time. There really wasn't any passage of time. New Miranda warnings they were given, and whether or not the subsequent questioning was focused on a new crime. The subsequent questioning was relevant to the crime with which he was charged, which was the murder in this case. Based upon the fact that his invocation of the right to remain silent was not scrupulously honored, there was a violation of his right to remain silent. Also, in regard to his right to counsel, there's a difference between when somebody invokes the right to remain silent versus right to counsel. With the right to remain silent, the police can reapproach the suspect after a period of time where they re-Mirandize him and he agrees to talk. However, when a suspect invokes his right to counsel, the police cannot approach him again. They cannot approach him unless they bring him a lawyer, and they cannot approach him unless the suspect himself says, I want to talk. In this particular case, it's unrefuted testimony of Mr. Holden at the evidentiary hearing that he told the police that he did not want to talk with them and that he wanted a lawyer. The state didn't bring anybody from North Las Vegas to refute that, so that's the only testimony we have in that regard. However, once North Las Vegas arrived, they approached him and they re-Mirandized him. That's a violation under Carter and also a Supreme Court precedent. Now, if appellate counsel had raised this issue on appeal, the statement would have been suppressed. And the fruits of the poisonous tree, everything else would have been suppressed in this particular case. Trial counsel was ineffective, as I came previously, in regard to journal entries and my client's priors. In this particular case, my client had allegedly written a journal, which was devastating. And in fact, trial counsel admitted that it was devastating. The court had ruled that some parts of that journal could come in the state's case in chief, and other parts would only be admissible if Mr. Holden testified. Trial counsel could have had the entire journal kept up. And in fact, he admitted that in the prior murder case, the White Cat murder case, which was a far stronger defense case, the only reason his client was convicted was because of those journal entries. And what happened in this particular case was that the state, for whatever reason, did not admit the journal entries in the case in chief. Nevertheless, trial counsel still counseled his client to take the witness stand and testify. When he was questioned during the evidentiary hearing of why did you counsel your client to testify knowing that you had that the state had neglected or by some oversight had not introduced probably one of the most compelling piece of evidence, which is handwritten journal entries by my client supposedly confessing to this murder. Trial counsel indicated, I thought he was trying to bait us. I thought he was baiting us into putting him on the witness stand. So trial counsel went ahead and counseled his client to testify. Now strategic decisions must be based upon, they must be objectively reasonable. It's not some reasonable strategy to put your client on the witness stand, thereby allowing probably the most incriminating piece of evidence against him to come in. That's what happened in this particular case. And trial counsel admitted, if he hadn't put his client on the stand, none of his journal entries would have come in. Albeit, except to defendant whether or not he testified, there's no dispute in this particular case, the trial counsel, it was his opinion, he encouraged his client to testify, they thought it was in his best interest to do so. which brings me to the next issue, which is the priors. My client had a prior conviction for murder. In opening statement, trial counsel told the jury, my client previously convicted of murder. Now, in regard to that prior conviction, the state had already indicated that they had no intention of bringing that in the case in chief. They would only bring in his prior murder conviction if my client took the witness stand. Now, what's important to note is that Mr. Ribble, prior to trial, had tried to keep out that prior murder conviction. In doing so, he had made the following statement to the district court judge. Jurors will learn he has been convicted of a homicide that occurred 30 days earlier. I mean, what is there left for us to do? They're not going to be fair. They're not going to be objective. This was a statement he made to the district court judge. Then, at trial, he announces to the jury, an opening statement, my client's a convicted murderer. And then he puts him on the witness stand so that murder conviction can come in. At the evidentiary hearing, trial counsel admitted that his client would be less prejudiced if the jury before hearing the evidence wasn't aware that he was a convicted killer. When I asked, why did you notice the jury during the opening statement that your client had a prior conviction for murder, he said he wanted to win the opening. And that was a theme throughout his testimony at the evidentiary hearing was, I wanted to win the opening. It seemed like it was a game. I wanted to win the opening. I thought the prosecutor was trying to bait us. So we went ahead and took the bait and put the client on the witness stand. Regarding the priors, he admitted during the evidentiary hearing that advising the jury, before the jury heard any evidence whatsoever, that his client had a prior conviction for murder, could do nothing but hurt us. Yet he counseled his client to take the stand. Again, strategic decisions that are not objectively reasonable constitute ineffective assistance.
Why did he put his client on the stand? What did he say?
But when I asked him the evidentiary hearing, in hindsight, do you think it was a good idea to put your client in the witness stand? He said, I analogize being a defense lawyer to a Monday morning quarterback. I don't second guess myself. He really had no explanation because if he hadn't, he acknowledged that if he hadn't put a client on the stand, prior to murder would be now. And the entire journal would have been out. And he acknowledged that in the prior murder case, which was stronger, his client was convicted because of the journal, thereby acknowledging there was really no way, there was no way to win this case with these journal entries, which were out before the counsel's client to testify because the state, again, for whatever reason, didn't bring the case in chief.
And when the journal entries came in, there was no limiting instruction on bad acts, is that correct?
There was no limiting instruction.
Why did he not ask for a limiting instruction on the bad acts?
Again, he didn't have an explanation. And just for the course of education, at the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Bible trial counsel had not read the briefs. The initial evidentiary hearing had to be stopped. And it was in front of Judge Corley so that Mr. Ripple could read the briefs because he didn't have a whole lot of knowledge on what transpired. When we had the second evidentiary hearing, he still had not read the briefs, so a lot of the questioning about why did you do what you did, his response was that was quite some time ago, and I don't remember why I did everything I did. However, his focus did seem to be, he talked about, I wanted to maintain credibility with the jury. In the opening, I told them my client was going to testify, and I turned my question to, but you couldn't possibly prevail in this case with these journal entries and the prior conviction, which he acknowledged.
Ms. Connolly, wasn't there some testimony adduced as to his testifying dealing with his fear, reference his the lives of his wife and child?
Yes. What Mr. Ribble McCabe, the defense was, his reason before his current stand was that he was going to testify, the defense was that this was a false confession. So Mr. Holden testified and said, the reason I confessed was because I was afraid. However, the problem with that whole defense strategy is it was reliant upon trial counsel being able to bring in Deborah Davis, an expert witness, to talk about false confessions. Again, there was no hearing on whether or not her testimony would be admissible until the middle of trial. There was a hearing in the middle of the trial to determine whether or not the court would allow her to testify and the court would allow her to testify. So his whole defense strategy based upon this whole false confession idea, again, was not objectively reasonable because he didn't get pretrial determination on whether or not this expert would be permitted to testify. And when I tried to question him about that, we kind of went in circles and he would never acknowledge that determination should have been made pretrial. It's my position that to be effective representation, you have to know if your expert's going to be able to testify. You should make that determination pre-trial. So his whole pretext of why my client had to testify was because he was going to say it was false, then I'll bring in this expert, and the expert was disavowed. Also, trial counsel failed to object to prosecutorial misconduct and failed to raise the issue on appeal. At trial, one of the last things said to the jury, in quote, "Well, my time's up."
Yes, it is, but you can finish your thought.
one of the last things Mr. Giacomo said to the jury was, if, let me get the exact quote for me. "The fact of the matter is, if you're going to collect the debt with a gun and somebody dies, you're on the hook for first-degree murder. That's not true. Extortion collection of the debt is not a predicate offense for first-degree murder. That was an incorrect statement of the law. It was the last thing that was made to set the jury. It was not objected to, and it was not raised on appeal by appellate counsel." And for clarification, appellate counsel was the same individual as trial counsel. Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Ms. Connolly, one question. As we're looking at this, how should we deal with the issue of perceived overwhelming guilt as a changing outcome based upon the errors you're asserting?
Well, if the statement had been suppressed, everything else would have gone out. Without the statement, they wouldn't have gotten the journal. There would be no case under Fruits of the Poisonous Tree. And also, I think we could have a cumulative error. A cumulative error is we have a presumed prejudice in this particular case. I mean, if we start to finish all the way through the case, there was no assistance of counsel. So if the statement had been suppressed, there would have been no case.
What about Vanessa Pena's testimony? Vanessa Pena's testimony.
She had indicated she had a blanket over her head when the shooting occurred, and there were some inconsistent statements that she made in the preliminary hearing versus trial. So it would be an issue of whether or not, if she had been without a cross-examination, whether or not the jury would believe her testimony. Because she indicated they came in, she had a cover over her head, she didn't hear the shooting. She didn't actually see the person that shot because she had that over her head.
The other two conspirators had left, and she saw your client standing there with the gun pointed at Garcia's head. She puts the covers over her head and hears a shot. The jury can't find that that's pretty substantial evidence of first-degree murder?
Well, it would have been some evidence, however, it's not nearly as overwhelming or has such an impact as all the other evidence. Mm-hmm. I mean, she definitely made some inconsistent statements, and as we know, cross-examinations, defense law, you can affect the credibility of somebody by pointing out their inconsistent statements. So they did have some evidence. It was nearly as compelling as those three pieces of evidence, the statement, the journal, and his prior conviction for murder.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Conley, for your arguments. Ms. Clark, give Mr. Giacomo an extra minute, and you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. My name is Mark Giacomo. I'm the Chief Deputy District Attorney, and I represent the state of Nevada in this particular appeal. I want to begin by focusing on what I perceive as an effort to finally weave their way through a case in which there's no possible way that Mr. Whipple had any other choice than to do what he did. And as a background, there's a suggestion that somehow he lacked preparation for this case because he only watched the video a weekend before, like they say there. Actually, almost a year prior, there was an evidentiary hearing that involved the playing of the entire video and a cross-examination of Detective Morgan on all of these issues. And then subsequent to that, there was a trial where the video was played. And what happened is now coming up on his second murder. Here's the position Mr. Whipple is in. I've had a prior district court who's already ruled on the suppression issue. He filed a suppression motion on the fact that Mr. Holden was under the influence of drugs. And during the course of that suppression hearing, it is painfully obvious that there is no basis upon which to suppress the evidence. The court rules so, and then Judge Wall says, "Is there any Miranda issue?" And the answer is no. There is no Miranda issue, and to this day, there is zero evidence in the record of a Miranda issue. What happens subsequent to that is that in the ensuing 2 days, while Mr. Whipple is in talking to his client, he comes back on the first day of trial and says, hey, for the first time yesterday, my client told me that he invoked his right to a lawyer when the initial police officers arrived on scene. He claims to have told me that before, but I have, he wrote me a letter, he claims, but I never received any letter from my client to that effect. Judge says, well, we're going to have an evidentiary hearing on it, and Mr. Holden takes the stand, and he testifies, and he testified inconsistently to what he testified 2 days before when he said he hadn't really had any memory of anything because he was so high on drugs, and he never mentions that he had a conversation with the Metro officers that took him into custody or anything else. He says the Metro officers that took him into custody were in uniform, which turns out not to be true. And he claims to have been Mirandized by Metro and then invoked his right to both remain silent and a lawyer. At the end of Mr. Holden's testimony, I requested the court that we be allowed to call the detective who took Mr. Holden into custody, and the judge says, well, you're planning on calling him at trial, are you not? Yes, okay. My preliminary ruling is that I don't find that this testimony is credible based upon a number of factors, but I will I will reserve my complete ruling until you call Detective Bunting during your trial. At trial, Detective Bunting testifies. He's a plainclothes officer with three other plainclothes officers. He's part of a PSU unit for Metro, has no idea what the allegations are other than he's a homicide suspect. He indicates that he did some investigation. Ultimately, he convinces this woman, Rose, to take the defendant to a 7-Eleven because they didn't want to have to wind up in a house with him because of the safety concerns. And when the defendant gets there, he gets pronged out. He gets taken into custody. He's asking questions like, why am I being taken into custody? And the only thing that Detective Bunting said to him was, look, you're going to have to wait for the North Las Vegas officers to get there. The testimony of Harley Morgan is that when the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department gets there, North Las Vegas, that Detective Molnar, his partner, Mirandizes the defendant at the scene. The defendant says, look, I'll talk to you. I just don't want to talk to that guy because he's being rude to me. And thereafter, they go down to the homicide offices. They read him his Miranda warnings again on video in the homicide offices, and he provides a detailed and full confession. At the end of Detective Dunkey's testimony, the judge not only reaffirms his ruling, but clearly says that what this defendant testified about requesting for a lawyer is disputed by all the facts in front of him, and that he fully rejects that he ever requested for a lawyer. Based upon that record, it cannot be ineffective for Mr. Whipple not to raise that issue on appeal, because you're obviously going to give deference to Judge Wall, the district court judge who heard the testimony, and based upon those facts, there is simply no basis to assert that there was a Miranda violation. The other overwhelming issue for Mr. Whipple is now I have a case in which not only have an eyewitness like the court described, Justice Hardesty described, but now I'm faced with, by Mr. Whipple, a detailed confession, one of which has no police coercive argument, read technique argument whatsoever. It fully matches all the physical evidence in this case, and despite that fact, and I know Ms. Connelly says if you suppress the statement somehow the journal doesn't come in, they had probable cause to arrest Mr. Holden because of the identification by Vanessa Pena in the photo lineup. So how it is that somehow the journal is the fruit of the poisonous tree, I have no idea, and what argument could be made that the journal wouldn't exist. And now there's a journal in which there are a number of things, and I know that Justice Cherry, you asked about was there a limiting instruction. The court actually precluded me from getting into any bad acts from the journal instructions, with the exception of the argument by the defense that when he says, I did drug deal after drug deal with Smokey, and now he acts like he doesn't know me, which is a reference to the co-defendant in this particular case and the acts that he's committing in this case as being an enforcer on a drug deal. Judge Wall, and I offered at that time to redact it out in some way, and Judge Wall was concerned that any redaction was going to change the meaning, and Judge Wall said, I don't find this to be a bad act. And so for Judge to suggest that Mr. Whipple was going to request a Tavares instruction, at the evidentiary hearing when he was crossed on this, he was being asked about a Tavares instruction related to the fact of his prior convictions coming in. And as far as I'm aware, this court has never said in an impeachment situation that there's a Tavares instruction that needs to be applied. And you may, in fact, rule that way at some point, but you can't expect a lawyer 8 years ago to anticipate, and I'm not even sure that Tavares was out 8 years ago when this trial, in fact, occurred. So Mr. Whipple looks at my evidence and he looks, says to himself, what is my possible defense? Well, my first effort is, let me sanitize the instructions if I put my client, or the prior convictions if I put my client on the stand. And he makes that effort.
How does he justify that? How do you justify, as a defense attorney, starting out your opening argument by, oh, by the way, my client was convicted of murder, and now he's charged with murder?
And that's, to me, okay,
but the second prong, I don't know if we can reach the second prong about the prejudice in this particular case because of the, what we may view as overwhelming evidence, but come on. How does he justify that when you got him on the stand? And I've been on the stand a number of times when my clients had accused me of ineffective, and that's when the DA's office shows what great defense attorneys we all are, even though we make these horrible mistakes sometimes, like putting a client on the stand when he's charged with murder, when he's been convicted of murder. How did he justify it in the evidentiary hearing?
As Ms. Connolly noted, at the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Whipple's recollection of what actually occurred and his reasons for it, because it was so much later than the trial that actually occurred, and it was apparent he didn't, but the record at trial demonstrates what his motives were and what his strategy was, and I'd like to discuss that a little bit because I recognize that, you know, the initial reaction is, oh my God, Mr. Whipple did something ineffective, but in essence, he was left with no choice. He made an effort to sanitize the convictions in front of the court, and the court rejected that. No, if he testifies, his first degree murder is going to come in, and that was on the 4th. He spent several days talking to his client, and at the end, there was a hearing in front of the judge, and what Mr. Whipple essentially says is, I don't see any other defense in this case other than a false confession, and I don't see any other way that I can get in evidence that there was a false confession without putting my client on the stand. I just don't see any other way to defend this case. And he's right. There is zero other way to defend this case.
Did the trial judge know that he was going to put the defendant on the stand and that he was going to give an opening statement that this client had previously been convicted of murder?
Yes.
Did the trial judge try to take any action to say, to advise the defendant, you know, your murder conviction's going to come in? When you take the stand, you're going to be impeached.
Yes.
Did the trial judge do anything?
Yes. At the end of Mr. Whipple making this record, Judge Wall asks Mr. Holden his hand up and says to him, look, you know, this is, recognize that it's a difficult choice for you, but your lawyer just told me about the strategic decisions that you've made about the best way to defend this case, and you pretty much have no other choice but to do that. Have you discussed this with him? Do you agree with him that this is the best plan to go forward? And you recognize that he's going to say in opening that you have been convicted of another murder. And Mr. Oldman says, yes, I don't think that I have any other defense. And he's right. And what Ms. Connolly says, he stands up and says, my client is convicted of murder in opening. Well, what will his other choice be? His other choice is to put him on the stand, and now the jury has listened to all the evidence, and it gets popped off on the stand in the defense case that his client has been convicted of another murder. And so what Mr. Whipple was trying to take was the punch of what we were going to do on cross-examination of his client, which leads me into the second thing, which is the suggestion by Ms. Connolly that Mr. Whipple had an ability to keep those journal entries out. Certainly, had he opened with anything other than, this is a false confession, my client is going to tell you that, then I had something for cross that the jury didn't know, which is his prior conviction. But once that statement was made, then I was free to withhold the journal entries because I made my prima facie case by placing in his confession, which nobody can dispute is factually wrong at all, and the eyewitness of Vanessa Pena and the tie to the weapon that he so accurately describes in the confession at Rose's house. So I leave the journals out. What if he doesn't do that in opening? What do? I put the journal entries in because I know on cross I have the prior conviction of his murder to cross on. And so when Mr. Whipple says I was trying to bait him, I think that, well, either he misspoke or Ms. Connolly is reading the transcript wrong, What I was making was making it a more difficult choice for Mr. Holden. Do I still get up there knowing that I have the journal entries out there? And at the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Whipple said, we talked about the fact that these journal entries aren't in, you don't testify, they won't come in, that I have to testify to get the false confession in there. And we talked about it, and ultimately we made a determination that his only shot was to say that statement was false. And he said, I thought my client did a really good job on the stand, and I thought that was our hope. I mean, absent his client's testimony, he had no chance with that confession.
What about the expert that he tried to put on? How did that all come about?
There's a suggestion that the expert was untimely noticed. From the evidentiary hearing, there was 21 days between the expert and the start of trial, so I'm not really sure what that claim is about. But I do know that Judge Wall said during his ruling on the expert, there wasn't anything untimely about it. What happened was is that we filed, made a request, and I don't believe that we filed it till the beginning of trial, and motion in limine, we want to proffer as to what she's going to say. And Mr. Whipple had a problem with this expert. He knows his only defense is false confession. He's looking for a false confession expert, but he knows that the majority of those are going to talk about the Reed technique and the influence of the police. So he makes a conscious decision that he wants to put up Deborah Davis solely for, there are other situations out there where someone may falsely confess. And Judge Wall agrees to have a proffer outside the presence as to what it is Deborah Davis can and cannot testify.
When did this occur in the trial? Pre-trial or during the trial?
During the trial. It was based on our motion in limine that was filed the first day of trial. During the course of the trial, in the defense case, before, as she was about to testify, beforehand, Judge Wall held a hearing outside the presence of the jury.
Was this after the defendant testified?
This is before the defendant testified. Deborah Davis got on the stand and she testified to, generally there are situations other than police coercive environments in which people might confess. What the court found was, look, there may be a scientific basis to the Reed technique and all those other things, but you're not telling me in this particular case that that's what we're talking about here, and I find that this is not scientific evidence. And they raised on appeal the denial of allowing her to testify in this court, said that it was a proper ruling by the court, and in fact, it was a proper ruling. The suggestion that Mr. Whipple should have done something, first of all, I've never seen a defense attorney notice an expert and then file a motion limiting saying, hey, my expert may not really be admissible, so let me have a pretrial ruling on my expert, because that's a big sign to the judge that says maybe there's an issue here I need to address. This was a response to our motion that Mr. Whipple had to respond to, and then the court ultimately says, I'm not letting her testify, and then there's another discussion, presumably there's a discussion, because it's not real clear from the evidentiary hearing, Mr. Holden, do we still put you up or do we not put you up, and ultimately it's Mr. Holden's call, and Mr. Holden decides to take the stand, and he gives the false confession. We litigate heavily that I want to get into the evidence of the other Whitecap murder, and the court precludes me from doing so and limits me solely to crossing him on impeachment from his evidentiary hearing where he testified inconsistently. Mr. Whipple, while I recognize that it is unusual for a defense attorney to do what he did, he was in a position where he didn't have any choice. He was out of options, and this was the only defense that could possibly be presented in this matter. The only other issue I want to slightly touch on is the misconduct. And to the extent that Ms. Connolly suggests in two different sections of her brief, that there was some sort of argument of second-degree murder. There never was. There was a statement by the prosecutor, here's what first-degree murder is, here's what second-degree murder is, and in that she said felonious act, and she probably should have said implied malice. But that was just in a description and never an argument that this was second-degree murder. In my argument, I was explaining burglary, why the felony murder applies to the burglary, and if you go over to this house with the weapon to do the felony, and then you kill somebody in the house, then ultimately that's why it's a burglary. And I was doing it in an explanation that what the changes Mr. Holden made from his statement, why he only chose just a few facts to change, and why it is When you look at these instructions, he had to change those facts, but he could agree with the rest. It was a form of a admit what you can't deny, but deny what you can't admit. And it was never an argument and never a suggestion that this was a felony murder case. I told the jury that. This is a straight premeditation deliberation, but this is an explanation for the testimony of the defendant. And with that, I would submit it unless the court has any questions.
No, I'm fine.
Any further questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Giacomo.
Thank you.
Ms. Conley, thank you for your excellent arguments today, and we appreciate your briefing. The matter will stand submitted.